From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, China's image in the world, the price of one of the world's basic food crops, Israeli settlements in the West Bank, and getting ready to tectonic. China is facing its worst public relations crisis since the Tiananmen Square massacre in 1989. Pictures of the anti-Chinese protests along the route of the Olympic torch relay in Istanbul, London and Paris have been shown on the world's television screens. And there was also widespread coverage of rioting in Tibet last month, along with demands that China improve its human rights record. Now, as NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Beijing, the Chinese government finds itself caught between the need to look tough at home and conciliatory abroad.
China's state television is often heavily censored, but it hasn't flinched from showing scenes of chaos on the Champs-Élysées and Whitehall. Many Beijing residents say they feel insulted and outraged. The Olympics are supposed to be about world peace and athletic spirit, says software engineer Han Xiao. I think people who cause these disruptions are detestable. As an ordinary citizen, I can only express my anger at this situation, says salesman Long Zhicai. But I can't participate in any direct action because the government would prevent it. Journalist Li Datong says that the anti-China protests just reinforce the Chinese government's well-worn historical narrative that Western imperialists have always tried to keep China down.
Their narrative says that the Chinese people have suffered persecution for the past century, and it's only now that China has become a global player capable of holding this great event. There's a sense of national pride.
Amid the controversy, nationalistic Chinese internet users have blamed Western media for distorting facts about the unrest in Tibet. Today, Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Zhang Yu rejected suggestions that the government was stirring up nationalist sentiment among Chinese.
I don't think the government could instigate this, nor does it need to. This is a spontaneous response. Western media have aroused internet users' righteous anger.
Facing challenges to its authority from Tibet and abroad, Beijing is loath to appear weak or make any concessions. Human rights campaigner John Kam has encouraged Chinese officials to improve their public image abroad by making a goodwill gesture. But he says that Chinese officials seem more preoccupied with their image at home. He says their position is this.
We recognize international public opinion has turned sour, if that's the right way. One official actually referred to it as a crisis in international public opinion. However, opinion among Chinese people towards China, the Chinese government, and Chinese citizens and ethnic Chinese abroad has never been better.
Some observers think that Beijing could still salvage the situation in the 4 months before the Games, and that sports will prevail over politics. Shortly after the violence in Tibet, the Los Angeles-based polling firm Kelton Research asked 1,000 Americans what they thought about the Olympics and politics. Gareth Schweitzer is a partner with the firm.
When you ask Americans that question, 90% of people come back and tell you they agree with the statement that the Olympics and politics should be kept separate, and 70% agree with that statement strongly.
The poll found 21% support among respondents for a boycott of the Beijing Olympics. The International Olympic Committee says it may consider cutting the torch relay short in response to the protests. China says it will carry the relay through to the end. It says it's working closely with U.S. officials to ensure that the torch makes it safely through San Francisco tomorrow. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Beijing.
Rice, the staple of most Asian diets, is continuing its meteoric rise in price due to increased demand and reduced production. The shortage is beginning to bite among Asia's poor and creating concerns about the potential for widespread social unrest. Several of the world's largest rice exporters, including Vietnam and India, are now limiting their exports of rice, NPR's Southeast Asia correspondent Michael Sullivan sent us this report.
It's early morning in Bac Ninh province, just outside Hanoi, and the shimmering green rice paddies are dotted with conical hats belonging to farmers like Nguyen Thi Lan, hard at work tending the spring crop. Lan is calf-deep in the oozing muck, clearing weeds and golden snails from the stalks of rice she planted back in February. Come harvest time in May, she expects her crop to fetch a far better price than it did last year, but there's a catch. Lan says bad weather delayed planting by nearly 3 weeks, and because of it, she expects her yield to be down about 30%. That, she says, along with higher prices for fertilizer and pesticides, means she won't earn as much as she did last year, even though she'll be paid more for her rice per pound.
Farmers, and poor farmers in particular, almost always are losers in this game.
Robert Ziegler, Director General of the International Rice Research Institute in Manila.
With the rapid rise of fuel prices, fertilizer prices have gone through the roof. So both nitrogen and potassium, two key elements for rice, the prices have skyrocketed. So she's right. She's not going to see much, if any, benefit from the rising prices.
Bad weather, pests, and less land under cultivation are contributing to a decrease in production and an increase in price in Vietnam and elsewhere, leading major rice exporters like Vietnam to reduce exports to satisfy demand at home. And that's bad news for countries that can't feed themselves. A lot of what Vietnam does export comes here to the Philippines, where, as in much of Asia, rice is served at every meal. Vendors and customers at this market in the capital, Manila, say the price of rice has gone up nearly 30% in the past 2 months alone and is now out of reach for many urban poor, who depend instead on subsidized but often scarce supplies of rice from the government. Leonor Bating has a husband, two kids, and not much work. When she can't find the subsidized government rice, she says, she has no choice but to pay for rice at market prices. And in the past month, she says, she's had to cut back on meals as a result and serve smaller portions just to get by. Higher prices for rice may also jeopardize efforts by aid agencies to provide food assistance to people in need. Here in the Philippines, the World Food Program currently feeds about 1.6 million people on the southern island of Mindanao. But Deputy Country Director Agassim Wuri is concerned what might happen if rice gets even more expensive and additional funds aren't found to procure it.
If we are unable to meet our target, we'll do one or two things. Either reduce the number of people we plan to feed or reduce the food rations we intend to give them.
Last month, the WFP launched an emergency appeal for an additional $500 million to help it cope with the dramatic increase in food and fuel prices worldwide.
We need to recognize that the potential disruptive power of food shortages is enormous.
Again, Robert Ziegler of the International Rice Research Institute.
Look at the government's reactions. Vietnam is blocking exports. India is blocking exports. China has blocked exports of rice. Now, the reason you do that is to make sure that your own populations are adequately fed. And why do you care about that? Because if they're not adequately fed, you're going to hear about it.
And governments are already hearing about it in parts of Africa and in Haiti, where food riots last week left 5 people dead. Africa, Ziegler says, is especially sensitive to changes in Asian rice production. Nearly half the rice consumed in sub-Saharan Africa, Ziegler says, comes from Asia, meaning shortages here will be felt there, too, and the poor, he says, will bear the brunt of them. Michael Sullivan, NPR News, Manila.
When the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and the Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas held talks in Jerusalem recently, it was their first face-to-face meeting in nearly 2 months. The peace talks, relaunched at a conference in Annapolis last November, have made little headway so far. One obstacle is an issue that has dogged the negotiations for years: the Palestinians' complaints about continued Israeli settlement building in the occupied West Bank. NPR's Ivan Watson reports.
It's afternoon in the Jewish settlement of Pisgat Ze'ev, where Israeli children wait to be picked up by their parents after finishing up another day at school. Pisgat Ze'ev is built on a hill in a part of East Jerusalem seized by Israeli forces during the 1967 war. This tidy residential neighborhood overlooks a Palestinian community, which is separated from the rest of Jerusalem by a wall of concrete and barbed wire. Last week, the municipality of Jerusalem announced plans to construct 600 new homes in Pisgat Ze'ev. On the same day, an ultra-Orthodox Israeli political party announced that the Israeli government had also approved plans for a larger project to build 800 new housing units in Beitar Elit, a large Jewish settlement in the occupied West Bank. These announcements came less than 24 hours after U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice wrapped up the latest round of peace talks in Jerusalem. Rice reacted to the news by repeating Washington's position. She said, quote, settlement activities should stop, expansion should stop. Israeli government spokesman Mark Regev appears to be in agreement.
The Israeli government has a very serious attitude towards the issue of the settlements. One, no new settlements. Two, there's no policy to outwardly expand existing settlements.
But when asked about the 1,400 new homes the Israeli government plans to build in East Jerusalem and the West Bank, Regev had this explanation.
A city like Jerusalem, which is a growing city, a vibrant city, a city which has growing needs, it's illogical, it's irrational to think somehow you can just cut that off. The same goes for those large communities which everyone understands will be part of Israel in final status. Israel is willing to go a long way, but we can't be expected to do the impossible.
This is an old trick of Israel to say that it's natural growth.
Hagit Ofran is a member of the Israeli watchdog organization Peace Now, which monitors the construction of Jewish settlements. Since the Annapolis peace talks last November, Ofran says the Israeli government has allowed the construction of an estimated 2,000 new homes in the occupied West Bank.
After Annapolis, after the promise by the government of Israel to stop settlement activity, we found that all settlement activity is still going on in terms of construction that started beforehand, in terms of new construction, and in terms of new tenders for construction in East Jerusalem, for instance.
On the grounds of his palatial home overlooking the West Bank city of Nablus, Palestinian businessman and philanthropist Munib al-Masri points to the Jewish settlements and settlement outposts that have sprung up on nearby hilltops.
You see them all around, all these settlements on top of the hills. They are Israeli colonies. I don't like to call them settlements. They are colonies, really, because you see them all around the hills here, and they are there to antagonize the people.
The Israeli newspaper Haaretz has also been critical. In a recent editorial, the paper blasted the latest settlement plans, accusing Israel of deceiving America and itself. Ivan Watson, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Coming up, learning a new dance in Europe.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. There can be few Americans who do not remember, perhaps with some embarrassment, the last time a European dance craze landed on these shores. Do you remember the Macarena? Well, a new dance craze is sweeping Europe, and it's on its way here. Get ready to tectonic. Anita Ilash reports from Paris.
Welcome to the Metropolis, one of the biggest nightclubs in the Paris region. The music here goes by a lot of different names: electro, jump style, hard style, hardcore. But the only dance is the tectonic.
I am a French tectonic man.
The customers, like this man who calls himself Vlad Vladsi, are mostly in their teens and early 20s, middle class, from every ethnic background. They look like they were raised by Madonna and Marilyn Manson. Neon colors are the order of the day. So are slim jeans, tiny t-shirts, and outrageous haircuts. Something between a mohawk and a mullet. And then there's the dance. As Vladzi tries to explain, the tectonic involves a lot of arm movements.
I move my arms in the right, in the left. Put your hands up for G2I, yes?
It's sort of like you're an elastic band, says Jeremy Vachayou.
Un moulin, ouais. On peut dire ça comme ça, ouais.
It's like a windmill, adds Fabien Amadeau. He says it's a mix of a lot of different dances, voguing, hip-hop, the moonwalk, and smurfing. And the point is pure hedonism. The tectonic started in Paris 7 years ago. At first, it was limited to a few dance clubs. It moved into the mainstream last year when dancers started posting videos of themselves on Dailymotion and YouTube. What is the tectonic? The dancer in this online video asks. It's a dance of young people, he says, a dance with a special look. You need big sunglasses, a ridiculous haircut, a flashy belt, and a tight t-shirt. And above all, you must know how to move your body. Now the tectonic is also a fashion movement and a brand name. The dance has also moved onto the street. Here on the square at the Trocadero in Paris, dozens of dancers gather every Saturday afternoon to make up and share new moves. 21-year-old Narcos Vedrine says he and his friends don't just dance for pleasure. They dance because they want to prove something, that they're better than the others. But instead of fighting with fists, they fight with the dance. And then there are the apprentices. Rio Jumer is just 11 years old. He's been dancing since November. I'm electro, he says. I really like dancing, but you're exhausted if you dance too much. If you dance for an hour non-stop, he says, then you're dead. Rio and his friends can already be seen on the internet. The tectonic could soon be coming to a nightclub near you. For NPR News, I'm Anita Elash in Paris.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.